Welcome on into the Ted Randall Show. I'm glad to have you as a guest right here on KAIJ. Regardless of where you're listening in the world, we really appreciate your listenership. Right now, without further ado, today's program, all about ham radio, and this is Joe Phillips, the Ohio Section Manager of the ARRL.
Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH. I do not need, I hope, to identify who Riley is. But for anyone who may not, say, may have been doing vacationing on a planet Uranus for the last 4 years, Riley Hollingsworth is the person who runs the Enforcement Bureau of Amateur Radio in the Federal Communications Commission. He's an FCC officer, a lawyer by trade, and he has, just by sheer work, has reformed the enforcement, and so much so that no one hardly even knows his last name. We call him Riley, and as soon as you say Riley, everybody in ham radio knows who it is, and that's his designation. It's been a long time since anyone could say that from ham radio. I think the last person that could say that their name alone identified themselves was Mr. Maxim.
William Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH. Who has headed up the Amateur Radio Enforcement Program from the FCC's Gettysburg, Pennsylvania office, is a graduate of University of South Carolina. He received his law degree from Wake Forest University. Hollingsworth got his first ham license in 1960 in his home state of South Carolina and currently holds an advanced class license. He's a member of the ARRL and the Quarter Century Wireless Association. Hollingsworth, 61, previously served in several prominent positions within the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. In 1987, he managed the FCC's 800 MHz Lottery Task Force, in which the new 800 MHz spectrum was assigned in 13 cities. He also organized the FCC program to recover underutilized radio channels for reassignment, a program that withstood three U.S. Court of Appeals challenges. From 1989 to 1994, he served as Deputy Chief of FCC Private Radio Licensing, and then later was Assistant Bureau Chief in the WTB. In 1992, Hollingsworth was a member of the U.S. Department of State delegation to Romania to discuss radio licensing in the U.S. and opening markets to U.S. manufacturers. In 1994, he co-chaired an FCC task force on PCS broadband and narrowband licensing. Hollingsworth joined the former Compliance and Information Bureau as legal advisor for enforcement in 1998 as a result of an FCC reorganization that fall. Hollingsworth was given the responsibility for coordinating amateur radio service enforcement. After that, the program was transferred to the new Enforcement Bureau. At that time, Hollingsworth said, his message was a simple one. Our communication services in America, whether our telephone system or our computer networks, are the envy of the rest of the world. He said, our amateur radio service should be too. There's no reason why our amateur radio service can't be the finest radio service in the world. In the ensuing years, complaints were greatly reduced, and with a few isolated exceptions, the hobby has been returned to a law-abiding radio service for the majority to enjoy. Radio amateurs across the U.S. credit Hollingsworth with helping to reduce and, in many cases, eliminate malicious interference and other problem behavior both on and off the air. The result has been a marked upswing in morale within the amateur community. So successful were his efforts, Hollingsworth received the Special Achievement Award at the 2006 Dayton Hamvention for reestablishing ham radio rule enforcement and helping eliminate many of the problems that had been increasing on the ham bands. Well, word was out that this gentleman was retiring. And I guess it's been posted everywhere. It's been part of almost every press release. But Mr. Hollingsworth announced that indeed he is not retiring. He reconsidered, he talked it over with his family, and he just felt like, well, you know what, it's just not the thing to do. So he isn't retiring. And oddly enough, just this last week there was a rumor going around that he was already gone and that his successor had been named. Well, it's just not true. Riley is still with us, and thank heavens for that. The information that I just gave you is available up on W5YI.com, along with some really decent pictures. We're going to continue our radio program with Joe Phillips, the Ohio section manager of the ARRL, in an interview that we conducted some months back. And in this interview is a very, very, special story about Mr. Hollingsworth. So stay tuned and listen as Joe Phillips unwinds this one right here on KAIJ. Well, our guest today is Joe Phillips. And Joe is the Ohio section manager for the American Radio Relay League, ARRL. And how's life today, Joe?
Oh, just fine. I'm out of state at the moment. I'm in Connecticut seeing the grandchildren, or something to get to do from time to time. But I do enjoy making a quick phone CUSO, I guess, as they call it.
Well, you know, why don't you just briefly tell us a little bit about what does the Ohio section manager do with the American Radio Relay League?
You know, it's kind of a funny thing because, of course, you know, this is an elected position. The hobby is full of a lot of appointments, and people have appointments, but they're basically three elected officials. Two of them are the director and vice director of the various division you're in, and then in each section, and there's 71 sections, there's a section manager. He's an elected official, senior elected official for his section. Now, that means that basically he's in charge of seven ARRL programs that are run inside of the of his state, in this case, I'm in Ohio, and that's an entire section of itself, which makes us the largest section in the country. The reason being is every state larger than Ohio has at least two sections that it's at least cut up. So, and Ohio is the largest wholly contained state in the union. And basically, you know, the official observers, the public information coordinators, the local government liaisons, technical specialists, affiliated clubs, these are basically the people that I supervise. They become part of the cabinet. And, of course, I left out the 800-pound gorilla. The 800-pound gorilla is ARES, that's the Amateur Radio Emergency Service. They make up generally around 80 to 85% of all of my appointments. We have a local emergency coordinator in each county and that thing. They run a local emergency programs, coordinate with the county officials and with the governments there. And then it all filters up to nine districts, which then filter into a section emergency coordinator, who is the top official, again, appointed by me. And as the elected official, then, of course, I have to supervise all those people and represent the league to them and represent the league to the public, say, for things like this.
So how do you go about making a choice as to who you appoint to any of these positions? What's the criteria? What are you looking for?
I'm not too sure how everybody does it. I got lucky. I was in the state as a working for the Ohio Repeater Council for 5 years and got around the state. I got to know people, and I got to know well enough. I got to visit, and I got generally a good hand of the state when I became public information coordinator, which is a person I ran all the public relations and newsletter programs for the state of Ohio. I did that for another 8 years, and so by the time I became the section manager, I decided to run for it. I had pretty well a handle of various, and I got to know people, so that when these particular jobs come up, I have a pretty good idea of certain people I know who possibly could respond to them. I'm not too sure all section managers are, you know, get that much training. But I had about 13 years of it by the time I got there. But each individual job means basically someone who's recently worked in an appointment area lower than that, and then we have them, have been an EC in their county. Maybe they might make a good person who would run then the section emergency coordination of the entire state. It's more or less. This job has evolved into one, basically, of personnel management. You've got to know people, and you work with it from that standpoint. A lot of times, Ted, as you know, people will have long resumes, but if they can't work with people, it's the one thing that's missing that really doesn't close the deal. Working with people is basically is a top, you know, top choice job around here.
Well, let me ask you this question. Like so many organizations, when you get inside, you find out that, like, the focus is really not on the objective that's set forth by the organization by which you know it. Once you get inside, you find out that the main objective is all the internal politics inside the organization. So how do you deal with that? How do you keep the focus away from politics and the focus on the activities? Now, that's a loaded question. Maybe not a fair one.
Yeah, but it is, but you just do it, you know, unless... See, the funny thing about it is if you like that kind of internal political backbinding and things that will bring on, you know, you're going to gravitate to that. If you don't like that, you'll know, you'll recognize it, and you'll stick with basically getting the job done, making sure that whatever arrangements you have to do for the emergency, you know, that your 88 counties, for example, have their emergency plans, and those that don't, you know, you just keep appointing them until you find people who will handle them. As long as you make it a political gesture, that won't be accomplished. So it just depends on, you know, what you're really after. For all the political bite bindings, I find that most section managers absolutely do not like doing that, and actually gratify, go away from that as much as they can, and realize how much that, you, as much fun as that is, how much it really prevents you from doing your job.
Well, I guess so. So you get somebody in the organization. The organization's moving forward. You got your objectives and the goals and the things that you want to bring about and make happen. And you're really focused on those things. And then all of a sudden, you got maybe one or two people on the inside that are politically motivated. My question is, how do you handle that? Because that could be really a hot button. I mean, this is something that goes on even in churches, you know, that you run into a church organization. You have the same kind of thing. And I guess I'm in awe of the people who are able to manage those situations and get through it and keep everything moving forward without giving in to that sort of thing. And I just, you know, this is just an off-the-wall question, you know. And you hear a lot of people say, well, you know, I get involved with a club or I get involved with this, but I just don't have the tolerance for the politics. So obviously there are some folks that are not successful at dealing with those things. I've been told the Ohio section is a very well-greased, very well-functioning section inside the ARRL. So that's why I ask you the question.
I really appreciate that endorsement, and I'm happy to hear you say that, and I'm hoping that we can always live up to that. The thing of it is the answer to your question, there isn't any cookbook that I can open up and say, here, you know, try a dash of this and a little of that and a cup of, you know, just, you know, it, things, you're dealing with people. And anytime you're dealing with people, you know, whether they have the desires to, you know, basically do things politically, or whether they're looking for a resolution or a job or not, it's all individual as to how much of that they are one to the other. And, I just wish there was an answer I could say, well, gee, you start with this and then you move to this. And when you're talking about people, there's no way you can make an answer that pat.
Do you ever have to make somebody mad in a decision?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the funny part about it is at all times, of course, and this is the funny part about it, is in the back of your mind, you want to go for that very instinct that tells you, golly, this guy's made me angry, and I'm about to make him angry, so let's go for it and really mix it up, and you just can't do that. You know, however mad they get, however angry they are, whatever they call you, whatever they say publicly to you, you have to basically stay calm. You just absolutely got to do it. Because, see, the thing of it is whatever makes you feel good now is going to hurt like a giant headache a week from now. And you've got to remember, the giant headache is coming if you do something stupid. And so you just don't give in.
I didn't even want to get into this, but I couldn't resist because I've heard so many hams say to me, well, I just don't belong to the local club. There's so much politics going on in there. And I thought, well, how much politics could there be inside of a local club? Until I got in the middle of one, and I found out there could be quite a little bit.
You know, and the funny part about it, and this is the thing, that's the other side of it, too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get clubs that are entities, and they talk about this so much, you know, that they can't grow, or there's not people to come to meetings, or there's not people to take responsibilities, or not people who are around when you're looking for officers, or not people around who are looking for field day chairman, or for the CUSO party, or whatever it would be. And then you realize that when you ask some of the unaffiliated hams, well, they just don't want to deal with the internal so the internal politics creates the very problems they can't solve. But anyway, you know, the other thing, too, is that we've always been an individual type of hobby. People joining things has never been what amateurs do. You know, they've basically been independent, spirited type people. I have no numbers to back up what I'm about to say, but I doubt seriously 25% of all people who have held federal licenses have ever belonged to a club. You know, we still get a lot of people going to clubs and doing the work of clubs and doing the work of the appointments and all that. But, largely this is basically an independent type of a person and ham radio operator, and that's not something that's just now come across. I've been a ham since 1959. I've never known the hobby to be any different in that regard.
That's interesting. But you know, when you're focused, I'm thinking that when these organizations, when they're focused on field day, when they're focused on fox hunts, when they're focused on contests, then they really don't have the time to devote to the other things. And that's where the fun is. You know, we were talking earlier before we came on the air, and I was mentioning the magic of Echolink, you know, and all the younger people that are intrigued by Echolink because they can do so many things with it. IRLP and so many of these things that now exist that didn't exist years ago, which are all part of the new technology. And whether or not we embrace the new technology, I think, is going to have a lot to do with whether we're successful, in moving forward. I know in the broadcast industry, there is nothing the same as it was. I mean, you can't find a turntable in a radio station anywhere. And if you were to find one, you probably couldn't find anything to play on it. You know, and I think I think ham radio is getting that way as well, you know, because we have embraced the computer, we've embraced the internet. And we're moving in that direction. And
you want to find a group of hams who really smile when they're doing the hobby. I mean, really show enthusiasm. Watch a fox hunt, and particularly where you'll see kids too. There are certain areas this hobby now have that have basically got people gravitating toward them, and that's the one. The fox hunters, I find, although the hams are dedicated, I'm not saying they're not, but I mean that's the one where I find at the moment the most enthusiasm among the newer parts of the ham, the very spirited hams, finding people at fox hunts. I guess it's the game of it, and it certainly, like I say, it's made a tremendous impression on young people.
We've got to take a break here in a minute, but why don't you briefly describe to the listeners that may not know just exactly what a fox hunt is?
Oh, boy, how about that? I fell into that old trap of saying something with this terminology and forgetting that there's a possibility. Basically, a fox hunt is a transmitter transmitting a signal, maybe at a low power, but it's transmitting a signal and it's hidden somewhere. And then you take what they call DFing units, that is direction-finding equipment, and with basically triangulating the signal, trying to find where this person has reading, and this person has this reading over here. You try to locate and find where the fox is, and the first one to actually stand on the top of the transmitter is the winner. It is a needle in a haystack game, and it, like I say, because you build the equipment, because you have to coordinate the DFing equipment with the meters, with the transmitter that you're using, and the receiving equipment that you're using. You have to do all of that, and so that becomes part of the growth and the development, the old building portion of the hobby. And then secondly, of course, then you're out in a competition trying to find the fox, i.e. the transmitter beeping the signal off a 9-volt battery somewhere that probably over an area of about 3 or 4 miles could be anywhere in some park someplace. Or sometimes they'll have a 2-watt transmitter. And I know in my area of Cincinnati, Ohio, we have a big beltway. The interstate highway beltway surrounds the county, and the fox is somewhere inside the county, and you have to find it. And you've got several thousands of square miles.
And of course, this is a real good practice in honing your skills down, finding this hidden transmitter. Could at some point in time become a life-saving event.
Is it a life-saving event, but it also has a practical application for the hobbies, one of the hobby's great tenets, and that is self-policing. We have a lot of erratic hams, a lot of loose or interfering signals, a lot of poor engineering where signals are mixed and suddenly a third signal is being transmitted and is causing interference. The fox hunters, the DFers, can come in and they can locate that signal. It's a very practical application. And, of course, as you suggest, this has implications in the communications world beyond that as well. And I'm sure, who knows, maybe somebody that was DFing one of these days is working with our spy satellites. This is not unheard of.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with Joe Phillips, the Ohio Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League.
The word amateur. The word can mean a lack of skill, but it can also mean someone that does it simply for love of the activity, like in amateur sports. Ham radio people are amateurs in the best way. For over 70 years, they have provided emergency communications for free, bringing thousands of dollars of their own equipment, hundreds of people, and serving their communities all for free. The Amateur Radio Emergency Services are amateurs in the best sense of the word.
We're back with Joe Phillips, Ohio Section Coordinator. Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League. I want to make sure I get the terminology correct here. Well,
Or as some people have called it, the Ohio Section Mangler.
Okay.
I've been called that, too.
Now, we're going to get real serious here.
Go.
You told me there were some operators occasionally that get out of control. You know, do things maybe they shouldn't do. You know, sometimes unintentionally they transmit, you know, something that, you know, like you said, a harmonic. But then there's other times when they're just bad people.
Yeah.
And years ago, there was this dreaded object, this thing that every ham radio operator was deathly afraid of. And it was called the Wolf Hong. You know, and it's been very mysterious. A lot of people don't know what it is. I've asked hams, I say, you know, mention Wolf Hong, and they, what? What are you talking about, Wolf Hong? You've never heard of the Wolf Hong? No, I've never heard of the Wolf Hong. And if you look it up, you can see this. I mean, this object, it's a very strange-looking thing. Do you have one of those in your possession by any chance? I'm just curious.
Actually, I don't have a Wolf Hong, but
you're the Ohio section manager.
There are several of the replicas of the stick. It's almost kind of like a Y shape, but it's really basically looks like a branch that has just been broken off from other pieces of wood. And there's nothing really rhythmic about the shape at all. An odd shape.
It's
not very big. And I know that there was a bronze replica that was sold on eBay about 5 years ago for $10,000 or something, because it was part of a national convention of the league. And the league has the original, I think, or at least it says it has the original Harvey Percy Maxim, who started the ARRL, and actually has it on display in Newington, Connecticut. But it's a stick, and you know, the funny thing is, you suggested to me when we were talking off the air, because Harvey Percy Maxim, W1AW, God rest his soul, who actually started and formed the league, one of the first hams. Mr. Maxim started this as almost a humorous gesture, kind of a humorous ceremony. By the time I got into ham radio in the late 50s, it had gotten to be a solemn affair, and people had taken it so seriously. It's a great ceremony, and it's a ceremony that's performed only during conventions, national conventions, division conventions. And it basically has inductees. It's like kind of a secret society, or as they refer to it in the script, the wheel within the wheel. And the funny part about it is again, when you can either do it solemn, which it almost is never done that way anymore, or you can do it for laughs and the entertainment value, which indeed it can be. But before I get into the entertainment value, it is actually a ceremony of a very serious object of ham radio as a self-policing mechanism. That is that, you know, that we hams, we do not have to worry about the frequencies. We'll take care of our frequencies. We don't have to worry about outside policing. We'll do that. And this is what that ceremony teaches. And it's a very serious and very solemn ceremony as far as the script is concerned. Like I say, the first time I saw it, it was done with such solemnity, and it basically looked like Lord of the Rings in the low rent territory, you know, with swords and wizards and spirits and people in basically in costume robes with all kinds of noisemakers and fireworks that get set off, and actually a sword that is and a light which is passed around with such great intent, referring to basically the interference devils or the the QRMers and QRN, which is basic part of the ceremony. But the thing of it is now, of course, when you do the ceremony, you really don't, you don't have to be funny. You don't have to worry about any type of having any comic talents whatsoever. You play the lines seriously because the script has done the job for you. It's based with such this heavy biblical type of sentence structure, with the these and the thous and all of that, and it's so with such locked in old English, and all you have to do is say it in a solemn manner, and believe me, everybody has a good time.
Well, I
almost hate to bring it up that way. The idea that ham radio is self policing, and basically then after a while, because it's usually done in a convention setting during a banquet at night of a convention for the entertainment value. I've done this many, many times myself, basically directed it. I've directed the national conventions for the last two times. I've directed them locally in the Ohio section wherever they've been done in the division conventions. I'll tell you, just the one I remember more than anything else was Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH. I do not need, I hope, to identify who Riley is. But for anyone who may not, been doing vacationing on a planet Uranus for the last 4 years, Riley Hollingsworth is the person who runs the Enforcement Bureau of Amateur Radio in the Federal Communications Commission. He's an FCC officer, a lawyer by trade, and he has, just by sheer work, has reformed the enforcement, and so much so that no one hardly even knows his last name. We call him Riley, and as soon as you say Riley, everybody in ham radio knows who it is, and that's his designation. It's been a long time since anyone could say that from ham radio. I think the last person that could say that their name alone identified themselves was Mr. Maxim, because basically who has obtained fame through ham radio alone. But anyhow, getting back to Riley, this government bureaucrat, if you will, who is asked to play the novice. Now, the novice is one. See, that's how it starts. A novice is asked to come part of the Wufong. They bring him in, and they travel through all these travails. That's the story line. Riley came in first place dressed in coveralls, and he played a hayseed, had this great big bumbling hat, his huge piece of straw coming out of his teeth that he was picking with it from time to time, and laid on a kind of a Dixie drawl that just was thick, and he just kept getting thicker and thicker as the night ran on. He just brought the house down. And again, although the lines were the way a script is plays it, he basically is probably one of the more entertaining parts, again, that I've ever seen of a Wufong. But, yes, the Wufong is, well, how would we say this? It's a ceremony. It's a lesson. But it's also entertaining as well.
And that's an unusual name, Hiram. You don't hear too many people named Hiram, at least not in this day and time. So that carries.
You want to hear something unusual about Mr. Maxim?
Sure.
The New York Herald Tribune ran a third of a page of his obituary in 1935 when he died. A third of a page. That's how long the obituary was. That's how important this person was, because he was an inventor. He worked in silencing. He did a lot of window silencing. The windows you used to, when you operated them up and down, used to creak and make the most ungodly noise, and he was able to bring that noise down. He worked with silencers for guns, and making actual gun silencers, and that was basically stock as trade. He held many, many patents for both those industries, and created whole groups of industries around his inventions. His activities as the man who ran and started the American Radio Relay League, the man who was the foremost amateur radio operator of us all that we've come to know about, was basically three-quarters of one sentence. It was a parenthetical part of a sentence. Now, that's how much, this is the person we revere, and we should, and he has earned every bit of it. But his majesty and his worth and his work on this world was so immense in the other fields that his work with ham radio is that small that it didn't even merit in an entire sentence in his obituary that ran through a third of a page. So, it's just something I've always found interesting for us who run across him, and for all the things that he did for amateur radio, that his work was way beyond ham radio.
Well, did he not, and if I remember correctly, and I may be off here, but was he not also, did he not, some of his compatriots, the people who he knew and communicated with and even competed with, were folks like Nikola Tesla, and even Thomas Edison? I mean, were they not in the same time period, and then they were not? And I believe, I'm not absolutely sure of this, but it seems like Hiram Percy Maxim also had some sort of a connection with Mark Twain. I've read some of this somewhere, and they're all, of course, these fellows all existed, I guess, in the same period of time. And I may be off, but at least that's something that
he would certainly be in the period with those inventors. Because he certainly held a place in the world of inventions. Again, as I was saying,
that something else that I had read about him is that he had a fascination with the planet Mars, and he had written some things on that. So he was a thinker. This guy really, So I guess when I got my first look at a Wufong, I figured, that thing's got to have some sort of functionality to it. But he was really a master at this sort of thing. So being part of an organization,
well, he had quite an imagination. But getting back to the Wufong again, and getting back to it as a ceremony. The funny part about it is I'm not as shocked about people not knowing that much about the Wufong. Only when we run across, say, the conventions, and we actually do it at the conventions and either in division convention or national convention, or we're actually doing the ceremony. As I said before, hams are not joiners. To the most part. So, you know, we're talking about a small percentage of hams that would involve themselves in these types of activities to begin with, that would even run up against it. I don't want to say the silliness of it, but the way sometimes the entertainment, the way it's treated and so forth, is makes it look a little archaic. In fact, actually, that's the humorous aspect of it, how archaic it looks, say, to a modern audience. So, Ted, the fact that it's not too many people that really come across in amateur radio who are hams, that doesn't surprise me.
Listen, we're coming up on a break. Let's take that break, and
okay.
We'll be back on the other side. Joe Phillips, the section coordinator, head of the Ohio ARRL
section. Section manager one of these days.
Yeah, I'll get it one of these days. If you have to get the Wufong after me here. Is what it is.
The word emergency, it means something unexpected has gone terribly wrong. Normal ways of doing things are not working. The fastest way to turn an emergency into a full disaster is to lose communications. Ham radio people understand emergencies. For over 70 years, they have provided free emergency communications for organizations. Ham radio, when normal ways of communications fail or get overloaded. The Amateur Radio Emergency Service. We'll be there.
We're back, and we're talking with Joe Phillips, the section manager for the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League. But you know what? And I'll tell you something. When we were off during the break, I wasn't supposed to repeat this, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. Joe tells me that for all of you guys out there that Hiram Percy Maxim used to refer to as LIDS, you better be careful because there really is a Wufong. And you never know when a couple guys may show up at the door to administer the device if you've been causing a lot of QRM or a lot of QRN. Now, I wasn't supposed to say that, but I went ahead and said it. So, Joe, if you're mad at me, then that's, you know.
You know, to tell you the truth, of course, one of the local programs I administer is the Official Observers. That's the Amateur Auxiliary. My official observer coordinator has a group of people, and we run local interference committees throughout the state of Ohio, where they basically, the OOs have been working in the HF bands, and basically the local interference committees work in the UHF and VHF repeater areas for local interfering. Generally, I've found that 95% of interference is either indifferent engineering, poor engineering, or something that's happening that no one thought about, where two things are operating side by side, creating a third frequency. The amount of times that it is actually someone who's maliciously trying to damage the bands, or trying to interfere with the fun, or trying to have, shall we say, some type of making their ham frequencies their personal playground, is basically 5%, if that. It's not a big percentage. And again, as I say, most of the problems we find of interference, a lot of them are either poor or indifferent engineering. We did have a problem, say, in the Cincinnati area, which we're still looking into, where an individual is cross-banding with certain police departments, that is, putting the police department's dispatcher on the ham radio frequency, putting the ham radio frequency through the police department's radios. This is an individual who has, you know, quite a bit of technical expertise, because that is not an easy thing to do. But that is a rare situation. Gets a lot of attention, has a lot of people angry, as it should be. But it's really not the norm when you have interference on the frequencies. Believe me.
Well, I'll tell you what, from the standpoint of shortwave broadcasting, you start bunching a bunch of transmitters together in one spot, you have no idea how many headaches that can happen. And you can have two or three transmitters that's been operating normally for a number of years, and all of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, here comes a harmonic. Like, who brought this on? What in the world's causing it? And that's always a lot of fun to track down.
You know, and the funny part about it is in our real world now, where we have everything is hot and transmitting short distances, where you're making your internet connection throughout your home hot for everything. You have garage door openers, you have microwave ovens, you have handheld telephones, cell telephones, all of those, which are basically radio transmitters. That's what they are. And so, you know, yes, all these frequencies are banging back and forth, and I'm surprised we don't have as much confusion as we do, as we wind up with.
My son just went on a trip to down to Florida, Jacksonville, and he's riding along in the vehicle with all of his buddies, and he's got his BlackBerry connected up to the notebook, and the notebook is logged into Echolink, and he's talking to some guy in Japan, and they're all sitting there with their jaws all the way down. And he's like, well, you're talking, you know. And the guy in Japan is driving around in a vehicle telling him where he's going and what he's doing. And it's just so fascinating. You know, of course, there's the satellite communication and the data transmission that goes on. And, of course, a lot of folks don't know what any of this stuff is. They don't know what data transmission is. But in ham radio, there's a spot for everybody. I don't care what your interest is. Once you get into it, you're going to find some area that's just going to fascinate you to the point of exhaustion, if you allow it to.
And the funny part about it is that's true. When I was a novice, my Elmer was an AM specialist. This is the late 50s. And he told me every day, and this is the one thing he drummed into me, that the ruination of amateur radio was going to be single sideband. Just thumbed that into me day by day.
Slop
bucket. So, you know, I have seen this time to time. You know, some of these technologies, they move in, and people just don't want them to move in. So, yes, I remember this all the way in the back when I first earned my novice ticket.
You know, and it's funny because I remember those days. There was a group called the NAASSB. And I don't know if they were actually an organization or if they were just a loose consortium of of loose nuts, or if it was, but this was for the National Association for the Advancement of Single Sideband or something is what they call themselves. And there was quite a little tug of war going on. I remember the AM, of course, right now, you know what? A friend of mine came up from New York, and he works for a transmitter manufacturer that makes commercial broadcast transmitters. And he was telling me, you've got to get on AM. You've got to get on AM. So I went out and bought a Viking 2, an old Johnson Viking, and a Heathkit DX100, and I've even got a commercial broadcast transmitter in the garage, a McMartin Kilowatt, sitting there waiting to be converted. You know, and I tuned down into the AM band, or not the AM band, but on 75 meters on a couple of the frequencies and on 160. And with all respect to these guys, and they love what they're doing, and God bless them, I hope they have more fun than they know what to do with. But I sat there and listened to the static crashes and the noises and all the stuff on AM, and it was just hard for me to contend with. And it may be because of my years in broadcast radio, but I thought, let me get back to sideband where I can hear, I can hear what's going on. You know, the fidelity on AM is frightening. You know, these guys put on broadcast microphones and audio processors, and I mean, it sounds beautiful. You know, especially if you're listening on a broadband receiver. But, you know, the storm rolls in and there's stuff going on, and to me it's like, get me back on single sideband, because I just there's something about it. But I love the nostalgia. I think these guys are incredible, because you go into one of their stations, and I mean, it's like a trip in a time machine, you know.
And the funny part about it is that they are now breeding a group of youngsters coming along, picking up the old AM equipment and reconstituting and using it. And of course, at the moment, they're quite scared when they're watching the refarming of the bands, because they're afraid they're going to be put completely out of business. And, you know, there won't be any frequency left for them. But, I guess none of the modes die. You know, if that is the lesson here, you know, that there'll always be somebody that will carry them on and to carry the standard generation after generation, which, of course, is what's going to happen to CW as well. You know, it's not going to ever die.
Well, you know, I think, matter of fact, since they've dropped it as a requirement, it's really strange to watch people now taking it up as an interest. In other words, now that it's not being hung over their head, some of these folks have relaxed, and I've been watching at Hamfest young people buying bugs, you know, the ones that are going.
You want to hear the other end of that?
Sure, go ahead.
There are youngsters now who are using it in schools because they're able to communicate a language, and they can communicate all kinds of things, including words that they can't say outward, but they can say it in code that other people, including their instructors and their assistant principals and whatever it would be, wouldn't have any idea what they're saying, and they're getting away with it. And you know, it's not exactly the way I would want to promote CW, but it is a way in.
Yeah, well, I guess I recall the excitement of having a novice license, and what that is, folks, is the very beginning license. Years ago, they had this license called novice, and you had 75 watts that you could run, which was far cry more power than you could run on CB. And you were allowed to operate on frequencies, obviously similar to shortwave, where you could transmit great distances. And man, I remember getting home from school and getting there and firing up the rig. And I think the first transmitter I had was an old Amico, and being able to communicate with people, you know, all over the country, all over the world actually, but mostly over the country, and collecting those QSL cards and putting them on the wall. That was just, it was so fascinating. I mean, it was like unbelievably fascinating. And you got to the point where you weren't, the code was no longer an obstacle because you were so carried away with collecting all these QSL cards, you know?
Oh, yes. You know, one of the worst things that ever happened to me was that within 3 months of getting my tickets, this was in September of 59, I was in Youngstown, Ohio, going to school there, and Elmer was working with me. And I had a DX40, which I had built, and an S38E, which was the Hallicrafters receiver, a long line of their S series. And I was listening one night, and I thought I was copying a UP2 with a call. I think it was UP2COM, I recall the call. I looked that up in my listing there, and I see that that's Lithuania. I gotta be wrong. So I call my Elmer. He's listening. Well, apparently the window's good enough. That signal was coming in solid in Youngstown, Ohio. So they let me work him first. So I worked. I thought, well, this has gotta be easy. You know, 3 months I've already worked Lithuania. Never had a contact that good again. You know, it's like the guy that walks out in a golf course, you know, and gets a hole in one on his fourth day playing golf. You think, oh, this game is easy.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with the Ohio Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League, Joe Phillips, and we'll be back right after this. We're back, and our guest is Joe Phillips. He is the Section Manager for the Ohio Section of the American Radio Relay League. And you used the term here a little while ago, and I didn't quite exactly know what it meant, so I'm going to ask you to define it. I guess you were talking about the brown shoe effect or something along that line.
Brown shoe syndrome. Okay. Actually, we have spent a lot of time, Ted, you and I, talking about people in the hobby who are disgruntled or somehow they don't quite get with the program or others or kind of loners or they have kind of an independent spirit. And so there may be sometime wondering, well, gee, what is that all about? It's what I refer to as kind of the brown shoe syndrome. In other words, basically, ham radio operators, and I've done a couple of editorials on this, are basically a pair of brown shoes in a world of tuxedos. And the idea being is they're comfortable, nice-looking apparel, but they just don't quite fit into what, or seemingly don't quite fit into what's there. Well, it's not quite true, but a number of people can get to that. Used to be that someone had held a ham radio ticket, practically in the 50s and 60s and 70s, as you and I were talking, was using equipment and doing things, talking to people across the world, that was fascinating just on the face of it. Bring somebody into your shack, which is the place where you have all your equipment, or essentially you just talked about the things that you did and showed the cards that people all over the world sent you. saying, I talked to this person, I contacted him, I contacted this person over and over again. I've talked to 150 countries, 220 countries, or whatever it would be. Well, modern technology's caught up with us. And now that is no longer, on the face of it, fascinating to the general public. We're not held into that solid esteem, and that's what I mean about being that pair of brown shoes in a world of classy black tuxedos. You know, it just don't, we're there and we exist, but we don't quite fit in, and you know, we can be put into the closet somewhere, and you know, and kind of kept by ourselves, but don't bother anyone else with their fancy cellular telephones and their new iPhones and their data text messaging equipment and so forth. You know, we don't want to hear about that anymore. I don't want to hear about ham radio. The truth of the matter is that we've always said we still, no matter what, maintain a backup. We're the backup category. Whatever these fancy damn systems that are going on of data transmission and information movements, all of these, we're the kind of backup systems. And I don't think anyone ever really understood that. Then along came the Asian tsunami. And for the world, at least, a whole set of the world, you know, portion of the world, islands, all over in the Pacific, were cut off completely with communication because the entire infrastructure was coming in. Hams went in. They had the frequency knowledges. They had the equipment that could run on generators. And they had a worldwide network of amateurs that knew what frequencies to listen and had a kind of a disciplined authority under the traffic handling to move information. Totally necessary. Cut off from the world, was it not for amateur radio? Largely, that lesson went unlearned in the United States. Then along came Katrina, and three counties particularly in Mississippi and other places, and, of course, the city of New Orleans, where the infrastructure was wiped away. And then again, we moved in with equipment that could move data, at least for 2 or 3 weeks. Ham radio was the only thing working. And again, we were able to finally prove in theory, and it's really too bad that we, you know, took disasters to make this happen. We were able to show to the world our true worth is still there, even though the technology may have seemed to have passed us by. But as you said many, many times, Ted, when you were talking, hams are getting into some of this digital technology, and they're moving it along, and they're just fascinated by it. But for the general ham, you know, it's a matter of pride to know that we can still make a contribution on the most basic levels of communications, you know, by single sideband transmissions over HF frequencies. Simple as pie, and contribute to the treasure of the United States.
Well, one thing that a lot of people maybe don't understand, but ham radio has a lot in common with shortwave radio, and that is what happens if you get a solar blast, one of these mass corona type ejections, and your satellite communications goes completely down. It's possible. It could happen. It's possible that a satellite can be shot out of its orbit by some terrorist group or something. The thing of it is that ham radio, a guy in his home with a car battery, a simple generator, and an antenna, he can operate unharmed, and he can operate without any infrastructure, period. He doesn't need phone lines.
Yep.
He doesn't need anything other than his radio and his antenna and his power. And there you go. You're good to go. And you can talk basically anywhere in the United States. And, of course, that's the purpose of field day. If folks don't know, when amateurs have their field day every year, they go out in the middle of a field and fire up a generator and a bunch of radios, and they see how many people they can contact. How many points on the globe can you actually talk to and verify?
That's a great point.
gives you
field day, which basically is a day where we're supposed to show the visibility of amateur radio because we're out in the open applying this. But this is what I was referring to, and you brought it up well, the whole idea that if it is necessary, we are available. We're there. And like I say, every year at field day, which is the fourth full weekend of June, that weekend, that Saturday and Sunday, weekend of that of June, is the field day activity, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday to 2 o'clock in the afternoon Sunday. And we as hams need to advertise where more of those locations are, because perhaps in the future, this is going to be where most of the people will run into amateur radio, because that's where it'll be the most visible. And yeah, field day is perhaps one of the great treasures that we hold.
Well, you can imagine the fascination of my younger son Matthew putting he's got his general license and puts an HF rig in the car and a 40 meter Hustler on top, and driving to work in the morning, instead of talking on 2 meters or on CB, he's talking to people all over the country. And it's just so fascinating, because there's no infrastructure. Yes, you can talk to somebody on a computer. You can talk to Hong Kong. You can talk to anywhere you want to over the Internet. But what happens if the Internet goes down? Who are you talking to then? And so it is very special. It's extremely special. And
the point that we made,
very, very fascinating. And field day. When you have a small station set up in a tent, because we operated field day this year, and when you get done with all your contacts, it's really interesting to sit down and just put dots on the map and sit there and look at that, and it's really awesome, and you think, my goodness, we talked to somebody in every one of those locations and could do it again. You know, if we had to do it again, we could do it again for pleasure and fun, or for... And let me just say this. The ARRL operates... the station W1AW out of Newington, Connecticut, and they're on the air with bulletins, and I guess they still do code practice and all the other things they've done for years.
Yeah, they do code practice on a regular basis in various speeds, and do the bulletins on the various frequencies. I don't have the list in front of me, but by the way, can I give a URL?
Sure, go ahead. This is
www.arrl.org, www.arrl.org. Anything you want to know about ham radio, go right to there. It's the home base of the American Radio Relay League, and it will move you off to people who want to learn about ham radio, or hams that have other things they want to learn about. It's the service of the league. Whether you're a member or not, you can make use of it. Because ARRL is the National Association of Ham Radio, and that is actually its function as the only body that totally is working for the advancement of the hobby. There are a lot of ham radio organizations that are working for various modes and do well, and we appreciate their work, particularly in modes and or various other small aspects of the hobby, like DXing and contesting and so forth, but ARRL is the only one that has it all.
I thank you so much. It's been interesting. We've been talking to Joe Phillips, the Ohio Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League. You'll have to come back and visit with us again, Joe.
Oh, thank you so much, Ted. I certainly appreciated being on with you.